This is Brian Lehrer. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably anticipating Robert Mueller's public testimony in Congress on Wednesday to see if he adds anything important to the public record or to grounds for the impeachment of President Trump. Since very few Americans have read the 448-page Mueller report, we've recorded five selected stretches of the report for your listening pleasure that we think Mueller may get asked about because they described evidence for whether President Trump committed conspiracy with the Russians or obstruction of justice. In this first excerpt, read by Amy Walter, the Friday Politics host of The Takeaway, and John Del Signor, Gothamist's editor-in-chief, you'll hear references to Trump trying to have Mueller fired through Trump's White House counsel, Don McGahn. You'll also hear references to Dan Coats and Mike Rogers, two of Trump's intelligence officials. This begins on Volume 2, page 89 of the report.
Substantial evidence indicates that by June 17, 2017, the president knew his conduct was under investigation by a federal prosecutor who could present any evidence of federal crimes to a grand jury. On May 23, 2017, McGahn explicitly warned the president that his, quote, biggest exposure was not his act of firing Comey, but his, quote, other contacts and, quote, calls, and his, quote, ask Ree Flynn, end quote. By early June, it was widely reported in the media that federal prosecutors had issued grand jury subpoenas in the Flynn inquiry and that special counsel had taken over the Flynn investigation. 602. On June 9, 2017, the special counsel's office informed the White House that investigators would be interviewing intelligence agency officials who allegedly had been asked by the president to push back against the Russia investigation. On June 14, 2017, news outlets began reporting that the president was himself being investigated for obstruction of justice. Based on widespread reporting, the president knew that such an investigation could include his request for Comey's loyalty, his request that Comey, quote, let Flynn go, his outreach to Coates and Rogers, and his termination of Comey and statement to the Russian foreign minister that the termination had relieved, quote, great pressure related to Russia. And on June 16, 2017, the day before he directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president publicly acknowledged that his conduct was under investigation by a federal prosecutor, tweeting, I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director. C. Intent. Substantial evidence indicates that the president's attempts to remove the special counsel were linked to the special counsel's oversight of investigations that involved the president's conduct, and most immediately to reports that the president was being investigated for potential obstruction of justice. Before the president terminated Comey, the president considered it critically important that he was not under investigation and that the public not erroneously think he was being investigated. As described in Volume 2, Section 2D, Supra, advisors perceived the president, while he was drafting the Comey termination letter, to be concerned more than anything else about getting out that he was not personally under investigation. When the president learned of the appointment of the special counsel on May 17, 2017, he expressed further concern about the investigation, saying, quote, this is the end of my presidency. The president also faulted Sessions for recusing, saying, quote, you were supposed to protect me.
On June 14, 2017, when the Washington Post reported that the special counsel was investigating the president for obstruction of justice, the president was facing what he had wanted to avoid, a criminal investigation into his own conduct that was the subject of widespread media attention. The evidence indicates that news of the obstruction investigation prompted the president to call McGahn and seek to have the special counsel removed. By mid-June, the Department of Justice had already cleared the special counsel's service, and the president's advisors had told him that the claimed conflicts of interest were, quote, silly, and did not provide a basis to remove the special counsel. On June 13, 2017, the acting attorney general testified before Congress that no good cause for removing the special counsel existed, and the president dictated a press statement to Sanders saying he had no intention of firing the special counsel. But the next day, the media reported that the president was under investigation for obstruction of justice, and the special counsel was interviewing witnesses about events related to possible obstruction, spurring the president to write critical tweets about the special counsel's investigation. The president called McGahn at home that night and then called him on Saturday from Camp David. The evidence accordingly indicates that news that an obstruction investigation had been opened is what led the president to call McGahn to have the special counsel terminated. There also is evidence that the president knew that he should not have made those calls to McGahn. The president made the calls to McGahn after McGahn had specifically told the president that the White House counsel's office and McGahn himself could not be involved in pressing conflicts claims, and that the president should consult with his personal counsel if he wished to raise conflicts. Instead of relying on his personal counsel to submit the conflicts claims, the president sought to use his official powers to remove the special counsel. And after the media reported on the president's actions, he denied that he ever ordered McGahn to have the special counsel terminated and made repeated efforts to have McGahn deny the story, as discussed in Volume 2, Section 2.1, Infra. Those denials are contrary to the evidence and suggest the president's awareness that the direction to McGahn could be seen as improper. F. The president's efforts to curtail the special counsel investigation. Overview. 2 days after the president directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president made another attempt to affect the course of the Russia investigation. On June 19, 2017, the president met one-on-one with Corey Lewandowski in the Oval Office and dictated a message to be delivered to Attorney General Sessions that would have had the effect of limiting the Russia investigation to future election interference only.
So the president tried but failed to get his White House counsel to fire Robert Mueller. Is that obstruction of justice? We'll see if Mueller is asked in the hearings. Next, we have part of Mueller's analysis of Trump trying to get Attorney General Jeff Sessions to order Mueller to stop investigating Trump. On the media co-hosts, Brooke Gladstone and Bob Garfield will read you this one. If you're following along at home, this begins on Volume 2, page 97. In this instance, Trump tries to keep Mueller off his trail through his former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski.
Volume 2, page 97. In analyzing the president's efforts to have Lewandowski deliver a message directing Sessions to publicly announce that the special counsel investigation would be confined to future election interference, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. The president's efforts to send Sessions a message through Lewandowski would qualify as an obstructive act if it would naturally obstruct the investigation and any grand jury proceedings that might flow from the inquiry. The president sought to have Sessions announce that the president, quote, shouldn't have a special prosecutor slash counsel, and that Sessions was going to meet with the special prosecutor to explain that this is very unfair and let the special counsel move forward with investigating election meddling for future elections so that nothing can happen in future elections, unquote.
The president wanted Sessions to disregard his recusal from the investigation, which had followed from a formal DOJ ethics review, and have Sessions declare that he knew for a fact that there were no Russians involved with the campaign because he was there. The president further directed that Sessions should explain that the president should not be subject to an investigation, quote, because he hadn't done anything wrong, end quote. Taken together, the president's directives indicate that Sessions was being instructed to tell the special counsel to end the existing investigation into the president and his campaign, with the special counsel being permitted to move forward with investigating election meddling for future elections.
B. Nexus to an official proceeding. As described above, by the time of the president's initial one-on-one meeting with Lewandowski on June 19, 2017, the existence of a grand jury investigation supervised by the special counsel was public knowledge. By the time of the president's follow-up meeting with Lewandowski, the next sentence is redacted. See Volume 2, Section 2, G, Infra. To satisfy the nexus requirement, it would be necessary to show that limiting the special counsel's investigation would have the natural and probable effect of impeding that grand jury proceeding. C. Intent. Substantial evidence indicates that the president's efforts to have Sessions limit the scope of the special counsel's investigation to future election interference was intended to prevent further investigative scrutiny of the president's and his campaign's conduct.
As previously described, see Volume 2, Section 2.B, Supra, the president knew that the Russia investigation was focused in part on his campaign, and he perceived allegations of Russian interference to cast doubt on the legitimacy of his election. The president further knew that the investigation had broadened to include his own conduct and whether he had obstructed justice. Those investigations would not proceed if the special counsel's jurisdiction were limited to future election interference only. The timing and circumstances of the president's actions support the conclusion that he sought that result. The president's initial direction that Sessions should limit the special counsel's investigation came just 2 days after the president had ordered McGahn to have the special counsel removed, which itself followed public reports that the president was personally under investigation for obstruction of justice. The sequence of those events raises an inference that after seeking to terminate the special counsel, the president sought to exclude his and his campaign's conduct from the investigation's scope. The president raised that matter with Lewandowski again on July 19, 2017, just days after emails and information about the June 9, 2016 meeting between Russians and senior campaign officials had been publicly disclosed, generating substantial media coverage and investigative interest.
The manner in which the president acted provides additional evidence of his intent. Rather than rely on official channels, the president met with Lewandowski alone in the Oval Office. The president selected a loyal devotee outside the White House to deliver the message, supporting an inference that he was working outside White House channels, including McGahn, who had previously resisted contacting the Department of Justice about the special counsel. The president also did not contact the acting attorney general, who had just testified publicly that there was no cause to remove the special counsel. Instead, the president tried to use Sessions to restrict and redirect the special counsel's investigation when Sessions was recused and could not properly take any action on it. The July 19, 2017 events prove further evidence of the president's intent. The president followed up with Lewandowski in a separate one-on-one meeting 1 month after he'd first dictated the message for Sessions, demonstrating that he still sought to pursue the request. And just hours after Lewandowski assured the president that the message would soon be delivered to Sessions, the president gave an unplanned interview to the New York Times, in which he publicly attacked Sessions and raised questions about his job security.
4 days later, on July 22, 2017, the president directed Priebus to obtain Sessions' resignation. That evidence could raise an inference that the president wanted Sessions to realize his job might be on the line as he evaluated whether to comply with the president's direction that Sessions publicly announced that, notwithstanding his recusal, he was going to confine the special counsel's investigation to future election interference.
Excerpt ends.
So far, we've heard evidence in Mueller's own words of Trump trying through intermediaries to have Mueller removed or have him limit his investigation to topics that don't involve Trump. Are either of those obstruction? Are they impeachable? In this next section, beginning on Volume 2, page 107, we get more examples of Trump trying to pull other people's puppet strings to protect himself from Mueller. These have to do with getting Attorney General Jeff Sessions to unrecuse himself and asking White House counsel McGahn to lie about whether Trump asked him to have Mueller removed. Allison Stewart, host of All of It, will read second in this segment. Tanzina Vega, host of The Takeaway, will read first. Tanzina, take it away.
Volume 2, page 107. In analyzing the president's efforts to have Sessions unrecuse himself and regain control of the Russia investigation, the following considerations and evidence are relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. To determine if the president's efforts to have the attorney general unrecused could qualify as an obstructive act, it would be necessary to assess evidence on whether those actions would naturally impede the Russia investigation. That inquiry would take into account the supervisory role that the Attorney General, if unrecused, would play in the Russia investigation. It would also have to take into account that the Attorney General's recusal covered other campaign-related matters. The inquiry would not turn on what Attorney General Sessions would actually do if unrecused, but on whether the efforts to reverse his recusal would naturally have had the effect of impeding the Russia investigation. On multiple occasions in 2017, the president spoke with Sessions about reversing his recusal so that he could take over the Russia investigation and begin an investigation and prosecution of Hillary Clinton. For example, in early summer 2017, Sessions recalled the president asking him to unrecuse, but Sessions did not take it as a directive. When the president raised the issue again in December 2017, the president said, as recorded by Porter, quote, "Not telling you to do anything. I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to do anything or direct you to do anything. I just want to be treated fairly." The duration of the president's efforts, which spanned from March 2017 to August 2018, and the fact that the president repeatedly criticized Sessions in public and in private for failing to tell the president that he would have to recuse, is relevant to assessing whether the president's efforts to have Sessions unrecuse could qualify as obstructive acts. B. Nexus to an official proceeding. As described above, by mid-June 2017, the existence of a grand jury investigation supervised by the special counsel was public knowledge. In addition, in July 2017, a different grand jury supervised by the special counsel was impaneled in the District of Columbia, and the press reported on the existence of this grand jury in early August 2017. Whether the conduct towards the Attorney General would have a foreseeable impact on those proceedings turns on much of the same evidence discussed above with respect to the obstructive act element.
C. Intent. There is evidence that at least one purpose of the president's conduct towards Sessions was to have Sessions assume control over the Russia investigation and supervise it in a way that would restrict its scope. By the summer of 2017, the president was aware that the special counsel was investigating him personally for obstruction of justice. And in the wake of the disclosures of emails about the June 9th meeting between Russians and senior members of the campaign, see Volume 2, Section 2G, Supra, it was evident that the investigation into the campaign now included the president's son, son-in-law, and former campaign manager. The president had previously and unsuccessfully sought to have Sessions publicly announce that the special counsel investigation would be confined to future election interference, yet Sessions remained recused. In December 2017, shortly after Flynn pleaded guilty, the president spoke to Sessions in the Oval Office with only Porter present and told Sessions that he would be a hero if he unrecused. Porter linked that request to the president's desire that Sessions take back supervision of the Russia investigation and direct an investigation of Hillary Clinton. The president said in that meeting that he, quote, just wanted to be treated fairly, end quote, which could reflect his perception that it was unfair that he was being investigated while Hillary Clinton was not. But a principal effect of that act would be to restore supervision of the Russia investigation to the Attorney General, a position that the president frequently suggested should be occupied by presidents. A reasonable inference from those statements and the president's actions is the president believed that an unrecused Attorney General would play a protective role and could shield the president from the ongoing Russia investigation. The president orders McGahn to deny that the president tried to fire the special counsel. Overview. In late January 2018, the media reported that in June 2017, the president had ordered McGahn to have the special counsel fired based on purported conflicts of interest, but McGahn had refused, saying he would quit instead. After the story broke, the president, through his personal counsel and two aides, sought to have McGahn deny that he had been directed to remove the special counsel. Each time he was approached, McGahn responded that he would not refute the press accounts because they were accurate in reporting on the president's effort to have the special counsel removed. The president later personally met with McGahn in the Oval Office with only the chief of staff present and tried to get McGahn to say that the president never ordered him to fire the special counsel. McGahn refused and insisted his memory of the president's direction to remove the special counsel was accurate. In that same meeting, the president challenged McGahn for taking notes of his discussions with the president and asked why he had told special counsel investigators that he had been directed to have the special counsel removed.
So White House counsel Don McGahn refused to lie about Trump telling him to have Mueller removed. Instead, McGahn removed himself from that awkward and possibly criminal position and became Don McGahn, McGahn from the Trump administration. This next section is Mueller's analysis of evidence that Trump hinted at pardons for Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, and someone else whose name was redacted as a way of getting them not to tell the whole truth to the special counsel. This starts on volume 2, page 131, and it's read by Radiolab's Jad Abumrad and Anna Sale, host of Death, Sex, and Money.
Volume 2, page 131. Let's do this. In analyzing the president's conduct towards Flynn, Manafort, comma, redacted person, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. The president's actions towards witnesses in the special counsel's investigation would qualify as obstructive if they had the natural tendency to prevent particular witnesses from testifying truthfully or otherwise would have the probable effect of influencing, delaying, or preventing their testimony to law enforcement. With regard to Flynn, the president sent private and public messages to Flynn encouraging him to stay strong and conveying that the president still cared about him before he began to cooperate with the government. When Flynn's attorneys withdrew him from a joint defense agreement with the president, signaling that Flynn was potentially cooperating with the government, the president's personal counsel initially reminded Flynn's counsel of the president's warm feelings towards Flynn and said, quote, "That still remains." But when Flynn's counsel reiterated that Flynn could no longer share information under a joint defense agreement, the president's personal counsel stated that the decision would be interpreted as reflecting Flynn's hostility towards the president. That sequence of events could have had the potential to affect Flynn's decision to cooperate, as well as the extent of that cooperation. Because of privilege issues, however, we could not determine whether the president was personally involved in or knew about the specific message his counsel delivered to Flynn's counsel. With respect to Manafort, there is evidence that the president's actions had the potential to influence Manafort's decision whether to cooperate with the government. The president and his personal counsel made repeated statements suggesting that a pardon was a possibility for Manafort, while also making it clear that the president did not want Manafort to, quote, flip and cooperate with the government. On June 15, 2018, the day the judge presiding over Manafort's D.C. case was considering whether to revoke his bail, the president said that he, quote, felt badly, end quote, for Manafort and stated, quote, "I think a lot of it is very unfair," end quote. And when asked about a pardon for Manafort, the president said, quote, "I do want to see people treated fairly. That's what it's all about," end quote. Later that day, after Manafort's bail was revoked, the president called it a, quote, "tough sentence," end quote, that was, quote, "very unfair," exclamation mark, end quote. 2 days later, the president's personal counsel stated that individuals involved in the special counsel's investigation could receive a pardon, quote, "if, in fact, the president and his advisors come to the conclusion that you have been treated unfairly," end quote, using language that paralleled how the president had already described the treatment of Manafort. Those statements, combined with the president's recommendation of Manafort for being a, quote, "brave man who," quote, "refused to break," quote, suggested that a pardon was a more likely possibility if Manafort continued not to cooperate with the government. And while Manafort eventually pleaded guilty pursuant to a cooperation agreement, he was found to have violated the agreement by lying to investigators. The president's public statements during the Manafort trial, including during jury deliberations, also had the potential to influence the trial jury. On the second day of trial, for example, the president called the prosecution a, quote, "terrible situation," quote, and a, quote, "hoax that," quote, "continues to stain our country," and referred to Manafort as a, quote, "Reagan Dole darling," who was, quote, "serving solitary confinement," quote, even though he was, quote, "convicted of nothing." These statements were widely picked up by the press. While jurors were instructed not to watch or read news stories about the case and are presumed to follow those instructions, the president's statements during the trial generated substantial media coverage that could have reached jurors if they happened to see the statements or learned about them from others. and the president's statements during jury deliberations that Manafort, quote, happens to be a very good person, and that, quote, it's very sad what they've done to Paul Manafort, quote, had the potential to influence jurors who learned of the statements, which the president made just as jurors were considering whether to convict or acquit Manafort. And then we've got 8 lines that are redacted. Whole big fat paragraph. All right, on to letter B. B, nexus to an official proceeding. The president's actions towards Flynn, Manafort, and redacted person appear to have been connected to pending or anticipated official proceedings involving each individual. The president's conduct towards Flynn and redacted person principally occurred when both were under criminal investigation by the special counsel's office, and press reports speculated about whether they could cooperate with the special counsel's investigation. And the president's conduct towards Manafort was directly connected to the official proceedings involving him. The president made statements about Manafort and the charges against him during Manafort's criminal trial. And the president's comments about the prospects of Manafort, quote, flipping, occurred when it was clear the special counsel continued to oversee grand jury proceedings.
C. Intent. Evidence concerning the president's intent related to Flynn as a potential witness is inconclusive. As previously noted, because of privilege issues, we do not have evidence establishing whether the president knew about or was involved in his counsel's communications with Flynn's counsel, stating that Flynn's decision to withdraw from the joint defense agreement and cooperate with the government would be viewed as reflecting, quote, hostility towards the president. And regardless of what the president's personal counsel communicated, the president continued to express sympathy for Flynn after he pleaded guilty pursuant to a cooperation agreement, stating that Flynn had, quote, led a very strong life, and the president, quote, felt very badly about what had happened to him. Evidence concerning the president's conduct towards Manafort indicates that the president intended to encourage Manafort to not cooperate with the government. Before Manafort was convicted, the president repeatedly stated that Manafort had been treated unfairly. One day after Manafort was convicted on 8 felony charges and potentially faced a lengthy prison term, the president said that Manafort was, quote, a brave man for refusing to, quote, break, and that, quote, flipping, quote, almost ought to be outlawed. At the same time, although the president had privately told aides he did not like Manafort, he publicly called Manafort a, quote, good man, and said he had, quote, a wonderful family. And when the president was asked whether he was considering a pardon for Manafort, the president did not respond directly and instead said that he had, quote, great respect for what Manafort's done in terms of what he's going through. The president added that, quote, some of the charges they threw against him, every consultant, every lobbyist in Washington probably does. In light of the president's counsel's previous statements that the investigations, quote, might get cleaned up with some presidential pardons, and that a pardon would be possible if the president, quote, comes to the conclusion that you have been treated unfairly, the evidence supports the inference that the president intended Manafort to believe that he could receive a pardon, which would make cooperation with the government as a means of obtaining a lesser sentence unnecessary. We also examined the evidence of the president's intent in making public statements about Manafort at the beginning of his trial and when the jury was deliberating. Some evidence supports a conclusion that the president intended, at least in part, to influence the jury. The trial generated widespread publicity, and as the jury began to deliberate, commentators suggested that an acquittal would add to pressure to end the special counsel's investigation. By publicly stating on the second day of deliberations that Manafort, quote, happens to be a very good person, and that, quote, it's very sad what they've done to Paul Manafort, right after calling the special counsel's investigation a, quote, rigged witch hunt, the president's statements could, if they reach jurors, have the natural tendency to engender sympathy for Manafort among jurors, and a fact finder could infer that the president intended that result. But there are alternative explanations for the president's comments, including that he genuinely felt sorry for Manafort, or that his goal was not to influence the jury, but to influence public opinion. The president's comments also could have been intended to continue sending a message to Manafort that a pardon was possible. As described above, the president made his comments about Manafort being, quote, a very good person, immediately after declining to answer a question about whether he would pardon Manafort.
Okay, gang, if you've gotten this far, you must really be interested in this. And now you get rewarded with Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Meretz from our podcast, Trump Inc., reading a little bit of Volume 1, the one on conspiracy with Russia, and a bit of Volume 2, having to do with one of Trump Inc.'s journalistic obsessions, the Trump Tower Moscow negotiations that were taking place during the campaign, and the efforts to cover them up. Largely, those efforts were by Michael Cohen on Trump's behalf.
On April 9, 2018, FBI agents working with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York executed search warrants on Cohen's home, hotel room, and office. That day, the president spoke to reporters and said he had just heard that they broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys, a good man. The president called the searches a real disgrace and said, "It's an attack on our country in a true sense. It's an attack on what we all stand for." Cohen said that after the searches, he was concerned that he was an open book, that he did not want issues arising from the payments to women to come out, and that his false statements to Congress were a big concern. A few days after the searches, the president called Cohen. According to Cohen, the president said he wanted to check in and asked if Cohen was okay, and the president encouraged Cohen to hang in there and stay strong. Cohen also recalled that following the searches, he heard from individuals who were in touch with the president and relayed to Cohen the president's support for him. Cohen recalled that, redacted, a friend of the president's, reached out to say he was with the boss in Mar-a-Lago, and the president had said, "He loves you," and not to worry. Cohen recalled that Redacted, for the Trump Organization, told him, "The boss loves you." And Cohen said that Redacted, a friend of the president's, told him, "Everyone knows the boss has your back." On or about April 17, 2018, Cohen began to speak with an attorney, Robert Costello, who had a close relationship with Rudolph Giuliani, one of the president's personal lawyers. Costello told Cohen that he had a back channel of communication to Giuliani and that Giuliani had said the channel was crucial and must be maintained. On April 20th, 2018, the New York Times published an article about the president's relationship with and treatment of Cohen. The president responded with a series of tweets predicting that Cohen would not flip. The New York Times and a third-rate reporter are going out of their way to destroy Michael Cohen and his relationship with me in the hope that he will flip. They use non-existent sources and a drunk-slash-drugged-up loser who hates Michael, a fine person with a wonderful family. Michael is a businessman for his own account-slash-lawyer who I have always liked and respected. Most people will flip if the government lets them out of trouble, even if it means lying or making up stories. Sorry, I don't see Michael doing that despite the horrible witch hunt and dishonest media. In an email that day to Cohen, Costello wrote that he had spoken with Giuliani. Costello told Cohen the conversation was very, very positive. "You are loved. They are in our corner. Sleep well tonight. You have friends in high places."
It's Ilya Meretz with the Mueller Report. Here we go. I'm going to pick up on page 74, hopefully around the place that Andrea leaves off. On January 14th, 2016, Cohen emailed a different address, info@prpress.gov.ru, with the following message. "Dear Mr. Peskov, over the past few months, I have been working with a company based in Russia regarding the development of a Trump Tower Moscow project in Moscow City. Without getting into lengthy specifics, the communication between our two sides has stalled. As this project is too important, I am hereby requesting your assistance. I respectfully request someone, preferably you, contact me so that I might discuss the specifics as well as arranging meetings with the appropriate individuals. Thank you in advance for your assistance and look forward to hearing from you soon." 2 days later, Cohen sent an email to pr_peskova@prpress.gov.ru, repeating his request to speak with Sergei Ivanov. Cohen testified to Congress and initially told the office that he did not recall receiving a response to this email inquiry and that he decided to terminate any further work on the Trump Moscow project as of January 2016. Cohen later admitted that these statements were false. In fact, Cohen had received and recalled receiving a response to his inquiry, and he continued to work on and update candidate Trump on the project through as late as June 2016. On January 20th, 2016, Cohen received an email from Elena Polyakova, Peskov's personal assistant,
Writing from her personal email account, Polyakova stated that she had been trying to reach Cohen and asked that he call her on the personal number that she provided. Shortly after receiving Polyakova's email, Cohen called and spoke to her for 20 minutes. Cohen described to Polyakova his position at the Trump Organization and outlined the proposed Trump-Moscow project, including information about the Russian counterparty with which the Trump Organization had partnered. Cohen requested assistance in moving the project forward, both in securing land to build the project and with financing. According to Cohen, Polyakova asked detailed questions and took notes, stating that she would need to follow up with others in Russia. Cohen could not recall any direct follow-up from Polyakova or from any other representative of the Russian government, nor did the office identify any evidence of direct follow-up. However, the day after Cohen's call with Polyakova, Sater texted Cohen, asking him to, quote, call me when you have a few minutes to chat. It's about Putin they called today. Sater then sent a draft invitation for Cohen to visit Moscow to discuss the Trump-Moscow project, along with a note to, quote, tell me if the letter is good as amended by me, or make whatever changes you want and send it back to me, end quote. After a further round of edits, on January 25th, 2016, Sater sent Cohen an invitation signed by Andrei Ryabinsky of the company MHJ to travel to, quote, Moscow for a working visit about, quote, prospects of development and the construction business in Russia, quote, the various land plots available suited for construction of this enormous tower, and, quote, the opportunity to coordinate a follow-up visit to Moscow by Mr. Donald Trump, end quote. According, page 76, according to Cohen, he elected not to travel at the time because of concerns about the lack of concrete proposals about land plots that could be considered as options for the project. Part D, discussions about Russia travel by Michael Cohen or candidate Trump. December 2015 through June 2016, Part I, Sater's overtures to Cohen to travel to Russia. The late January communication was neither the first nor the last time that Cohen contemplated visiting Russia in pursuit of the Trump-Moscow project. Beginning in late 2015, Sater repeatedly tried to arrange for Cohen and candidate Trump, as representatives of the Trump Organization, to travel to Russia to meet with Russian government officials and possible financing partners. In December 2015, Sater sent Cohen a number of emails about logistics for traveling to Russia for meetings. On December 19, 2015, Sater wrote, please call me. I have Evgeny Dvoskin on the other line. He needs a copy of your and Donald's passports. They need a scan of every page of the passports. Invitations and visas will be issued this week by VTB Bank to discuss financing for Trump Tower Moscow. Politically, neither Putin's office nor Ministry of Foreign Affairs cannot issue invites, so they are inviting commercially/business. VTB is Russia's second biggest bank, and VTB Bank CEO Andrei Kostin will be at all meetings with Putin so that it is a business meeting, not political. We will be invited to Russian consulate this week to receive invite and have visa issued. End of email. In response, Cohen texted Sater an image of his own passport. Cohen told the office that at one point he requested a copy of candidate Trump's passport from Rona Graff, Trump's executive assistant at the Trump Organization, and that Graff later brought Trump's passport to Cohen's office. The investigation did not, however, establish that the passport was forwarded to Sater. Into the spring of 2016, Sater and Cohen continued to discuss a trip to Moscow in connection with the Trump-Moscow project. On April 20th, 2016, Sater wrote to Cohen, the people wanted to know when you are coming. On May 4th, 2016, Sater followed up. I had a chat with Moscow. Assuming the trip does happen, the question is before or after the convention. I said I believe, but don't know for sure, that it's probably after the convention. Obviously, the pre-meeting trip, you only, can happen anytime you want, but the two big guys were the question. I said it would confirm and revert. Let me know if I was right by saying I believe after Cleveland, and also when you want to speak to them and possibly fly over. Cohen responded, quote, my trip before Cleveland, Trump once he becomes the nominee after the convention, end quote.
Well, there you have it. Five sections of the Mueller report worth knowing a little better in advance of his testimony before Congress. Now, this in no way is meant to be a comprehensive guide to what's important in the report. Just five out of many stretches of Mueller in his own words that we found interesting enough to read out loud. We hope you found it useful. I'm Brian Lehrer. We'll have live coverage of Mueller's Wednesday testimony, plus a preview on Tuesday and your reactions on Thursday on my live call-in show, 10 a.m. to noon on WNYC Radio and WNYC.org.